I'm Bae, and you're listening to Bae Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast, podcast recorded in downtown Baltimore. This episode, I watched Glass Onion, and I want to talk about it. But first, so the time at which I'm in that space where I'm beginning to pre-record episodes, or at least partially pre-record them. And so I obviously recorded what I wanted to say about Glass Onion before a particular situation happened that I want to talk about. Let me just go into it. If you do not watch football, I'm sure that you know by now, everybody knows by now, that during the first quarter of the Bills Bengals game on, when the heck was that? Was that Sunday? Must have been Sunday. Sunday night. So this past Sunday. The Sunday before this episode is released. A player whose name I've forgotten right now, and it's irrelevant, but to what I'm about to say, but a player performed a task that he would, that a pretty menial task, in that he's a football player. I think he was a defensive lineman. You're supposed to hit someone, or maybe, yeah, because I think the Bengals had the ball. I was watching it with my husband. and anyway, he was tackling a Bengals player. This is a Bills player was tackling a Bengals player, and it looked like a regular tackle. And again, you could find the videos if you haven't already seen them. You can find the videos. But anyway, it tackled the person as per usual. Person stood up, and I happened to be watching this live, stood up and then fell immediately on his back, flat, no movement. And I remember seeing this and live, because again, hubby and I were watching, and it was so routine that it didn't even occur to us to pay attention. And I think hubby was on his phone talking trash on some social media app, and I was getting ready to ask him something about something else. Like, we were just doing something else, but in the back of my mind, I thought it was wild that he just fell flat on his back. But never you mind, we kept it moving. Whoop, 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 commercials, commercials, commercials. We come back. The game has not resumed. What we expected to resume, we expected the game to have resumed. It did not resume. And blue, 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 you know what happened. Apparently, by now, everybody is aware, because they're heart specialists and surgeons who've weighed in all across the globe. Because this is such an unusual phenomenon, but it's not really that hard to fathom. Any sport you can think of, and I'm thinking of the most violent. So football, anyone where it's contact is involved. So football, American football, European football, rugby, baseball, believe it or not, cricket, anywhere that there is a potential for contact, volleyball, hockey. I think I might have said hockey, but hockey. anywhere where there's potential for contact, or so two things I want to say. Anywhere where there's potential for contact, a concussion is inevitable. You're going to have a concussion at some point in your career, and if you're playing on the professional level, you have been playing since you were a child. It's very rare for teenagers and 20-somethings to begin a sport at that age and then become turn pro. That's not typically how it works, although there are some exceptions, I'm sure, across the globe in all the myriad sports, professional sports that you see. Quite sure there are some folks that are just uber talented who pick up the sport and in a few years turn pro as adults, but it's rare. And so what we end up having is kids who are playing American soccer or European football or American football, basketball, baseball, cricket, rugby as little ones and like children and or at the very least teenagers, which is considered late if you start, if you pick up a sport. Because again, when you're looking at these professional athletes, when they're drafted, when they're chosen for their teams, and when they're first starting out, they're early 20s. You're considered old in your 30s, and it's real old geriatric in your 40s if you're playing a sport. Because again, most of these people have been playing since they were like 10, 9, whatever, some preteen. And so anyway, it's just inevitable with all of those years. But shoot, by the time you get into the league, by the time you get into the league at 21, you might have been playing for nearly a decade, if not a decade. You know what I mean? Because most of these players are in their early 20s, so they've been playing for a decade. And so that a concussion is inevitable, right? But outside of a concussion, what we also know is that there are lots of broken bones. Volleyball players blow out knees all the time. I think I talked about my experiences with that, but I knew too many high schoolers or freshmen in college who got knee surgeries for volleyball because of the nature of the game. And there was a school of thought that said, there's a way that you could fall without knee pads, but there is no such thing. Anyway, I mean, you can, and it minimizes the blow at the time, but over time, you got to replace your knees. Anyhow, yeah, I didn't know. I knew baseball players who had to have their elbows drained. I knew football players who had football and basketball players in high school. This is all high school, by the way, who had to get their knees drained because there was, oh, and wrestlers too. Wrestling, I forgot about that. But I knew a bunch of wrestlers who had to get their knees drained because they had torqued it or twisted it in some unnatural way in either a practice or a match and had to undergo, to prevent surgery, had to literally get their knees drained. And I won't go into those details because I realize that that's probably gross and I apologize. I did not give a warning before this, but nevertheless, even outside of that, I think you can be aware now that you can be in peak physical shape. And because, again, I think American soccer and European football are prime examples. Of course, you don't full body tackle people, but you do bump them. You do push them and you do kick them, and cleating happens in baseball and soccer, European football all the time, or football. I keep saying European, but the rest of the world calls soccer football. Anyway, cleating happens all the time, right? Because you need to get traction on the ground, so you wear those cleats. And sometimes, even in football, even in American football, I can remember one of my brothers played football, and I remember him telling me that a football player intentionally cleated him, meaning that he stuck him in his leg on purpose, which I'm sure is the thing that happens because you get competitive, people get petty, and it's not, you don't excuse the behavior, but I expect pettiness to come out in that way. Anyhow, but here's what I want to say, and let me get back to soccer, American soccer, and otherwise known as football around the globe. You could be, and track is a good, if you run track, racing is a good example of this too, but you could literally be going, and basketball has happened too, you could be going in one direction, and I'm talking about you in peak physical condition. You could be going in one direction and then quickly pivot in another direction and break a bone. No matter how much muscle is surrounding that bone, you can still break it. Why? Because we're fragile. And there are certain points in our body that, again, no matter how tip-top in shape we are, there's just certain things that your body is not designed to do. Or there are certain points, because we have all of these joints and we bend in all of these interesting ways, there's just certain ways that your body is not supposed to bend. And if you get the right amount of pressure or force, going one way and then you pivot another way, you could find a weak spot. You could expose a weak spot in your body and break a limb. It happens all the time. And I think one of the easiest, one of the most common fractures is a leg fracture. And it's usually in the, let me pull out my anatomy and physiology. It's usually the femur, either the femur right under the knee or right at the ankle. You know how in basketball, and this is global, but in basketball, they say I broke their ankles. Broken ankles is pretty common because while your foot and all of the, I don't even know how many bones are in your foot and in your, that are connected to your feet. There are so many different bones that are connected to your feet, but there's just, and so many ligaments and so much protection around there. But one of the, I believe if you Google it, I think one of the more common places to fracture or break something is in your foot. Because number one, we're on our feet all the time. Number two, specifically in sports, we're bussing and moving and all of that stuff. And it is too easy if we do not have the right safety equipment on to torque an ankle or break an ankle. And so it is a common phrase because it does happen. And that's exactly why in, I can't think of any other sport where you play it on the field, on a field where you don't have athletic trainers taping your ankles in a particular way to protect them, because ankle injuries are too common in certain types of sports. But I dare say, like, you could have an ankle injury in tennis. That's not a contact sport. And you could break bones in tennis. It's not a contact sport, but you could still break bones in tennis, depending on how you land. Anyway, because again, our bodies are not designed to do everything that we put them through. And again, if you are a professional athlete, you are paying, you are not only are you, have you been playing for a decade, at least a decade before you turn pro, even, or maybe in the case of tennis or certain sports, you can turn pro a little bit quicker. Nevertheless, the point is you've been playing since a child. And so lots of wear and tear on your body, which also translates to you're playing through pain. Here's the other thing. Sometimes what we don't know as fans is that these players, I don't care who they are, you've seen some of them go out in knee braces, some of them with taped up hands, depending on the sport, bandages somewhere. You see them go and you see them go out and you know they're playing hurt. What you may not know is that they're playing injured too. And I guess the difference between playing hurt and playing injured is a semantics game. But if I could think of it, if I could put my sports hat on when I was playing sports, the difference between being injured and playing hurt is you're injured. Oh, okay. Well, let me sit you out for a second. Let me allow you to get your head together, and boom, you go back out. If you are hurt, well, wait a minute. Is that the flip? Because how did they propose? One of these, so I'm just going to put it out there. If you're a sports person, you already know what I'm talking about, but there is a difference between playing hurt and being injured. And I think I said it backwards. The injured one is where if you were not a professional, you should not be playing. You need to go sit out and recuperate, probably get some physical therapy. Whereas if you're hurt, it feels more temporal. You can get through this thing, but injured is long-term. Like you need to be seen, and you might need some extended care. And there were several times where I was hurt or where I was, I can't say that I was ever injured. I did have injuries though. I guess I was always led to believe that I was just hurt, but I wasn't injured. Like it wasn't a long-term thing. But again, I've got a bad ankle from the years of not wearing the right equipment on my feet, playing in track in volleyball and those, especially basketball. I'm sure basketball didn't help me. And then also I messed up my shoulder in volleyball, which, yep, I messed it up in volleyball. And I didn't get proper care. And I'm not blaming anyone. I was always playing hurt or whatever is the long-term hurt. Like my shoulder always hurt. So maybe I was injured. Yeah, maybe I was playing injured, thinking I was just hurt on that particular game. But no, my shoulder still messes with me now. And my ankle still bothers me now, depending on what I do, depending if I don't have the right shoes on. So anyway, the same is true for a professional athlete. High school athlete, college athlete. I think it's more prevalent on the college level and then the professional level, because college or university, if you're in a sport, you're probably considering being eligible or your eligibility for the pros. And so the desire for you to play through the pain is heightened. I don't know that anybody is directly and outwardly saying, play through the pain. And I'm making my point in a second. I'm going to come back around to the original story. I don't think anybody is saying play through the pain, get it done. But there are all of these subliminal. I can remember growing up, we used to wear these shirts in volleyball where it would say this really silly phrase now, I bust mine so I can kick yours. Or no pain, no gain. Everybody has heard that. And the sentiment is, you know, it's going to be painful. This is painful, but it's all will be worth it when you beat your opponent. Which is sport. It's a competition. Like we're not in it to draw, even though we can draw in, professional sports. We don't like to have draws. Everybody likes to win or beat their opponent, right? Like, and that feels like two different things depending on how you're coming from it. And so what we know is that because only 1%, well, maybe not 1%, 2-3% of all athletes at the top of their game actually make it to the pros. And I'm talking about, it's no more than 5%. I don't care what professional sport it is. Only the elite of the elite actually play sports, and that includes the people or professionally, and that includes the people that are riding the bench most of the game or who are the backups. I'm talking about the team sports, including those people who substitute or maybe don't get as much playing time on the field. I don't care how big your squad is. All of those people are elite players, and there are thousands of players behind them that would want that particular spot just sitting on the bench. And so anyway, there's this immense pressure to keep performing and playing injured. And so, and then you go to the piece where in your contract, in every professional contract, and I don't think people think about this either, or the regular fan thinks about this either, but when these athletes sign deals with these clubs, with these sports teams, they've been recruited for a particular skill. And so sometimes there are bonuses that they could get if they achieve a certain number of whatever they're good at, certain number in football tackles, win a certain number of games or go to a certain number of championships if you're a quarterback. In basketball, certain number of points. Football outside of the United States, soccer/football. I know that if you, certain people, don't give me the line about the positions. I don't even know all the positions in American football or basketball. So I'm not even finna try to, I know one position I know is a striker. Don't tell me where they are. Cause again, I don't even know all the positions or where they go in American football. Why would I even try in football everywhere else? Like, I'm not finna do that. A goalie. Ooh, I know striker and goalie. Mm-hmm. Goalie is like It's not even like a version of the kicker. See how I would do? Anyhow, but here's my point. I know that because of a certain skill set that you have, you are acquired by your contract is acquired by a particular club or a particular team because of what your skill set is. And depending on how elite of a player you are, you could get bonuses for doing something really well. And so that is another incentive. That's my point there, that there's another layer. Not only are there like 1,000 or at least 100 people waiting to take your spot, and two of them are on your team already, because everybody has a backup. Every starter has a backup. So not only that, and that added pressure of making you play through your injury, but then you might have incentives to do certain things in a season, achieve certain goals in a season that would make you push you to play through being injured. All dangerous, right? And so here's my point. Now we come back around to my original point. That player on the Bills team suffered a hit that was pretty typical, but sometimes because our body is not designed to take all the bruises that we take, all the beans that we take, but through drugs and conditioning our muscles, we try to make it less impactful, some of the injuries that we could sustain. This person was hit. A lot of the cardiac surgeons across the globe have been weighing in and saying that this type of hit, you can be hit hard enough for your heart to stop, especially in a contact team sport. You can be hit hard enough for your heart to stop. It's just rare for that to happen. And indeed, one of the reasons why this is a big story is because it's just not a thing that we've ever seen before in American football. We've seen people being carted off before. We've seen even the game stopped for a period of time, but the game always resumed, and they always carted the person off. And American football players, I'm sure, like other contact sport players, are taught to do, you know, they do the sign where they're waving their hands or they're waving their feet to let their people in the stands know that they're cool, and let everybody else know that they're cool. And everybody claps when they come off the field and things like that. Or at least that's my experience for American football, but I'm sure it's the same way. No fan, even if you're a fan of the opposing team, wants someone's livelihood to be ended in front of millions of people, both in the stadium and on the TV, right? Nobody wants that. And so anyway, the reason why it was so shocking is now we know that his heart stopped at least two times. And the players closest there, well, first off, one of the things that we've been noticing probably has been happening for a while now, but what we've been noticing is that even players on opposing teams, when they see, and I'm talking about American football specifically, one of the things that I'm looking back on is in these last month or so, I've been seeing clips of players, even from opposing teams, trying to get the attention of officials and or concussion judges, because apparently that's a thing that football or American football clubs have. And I'm probably sure that football clubs outside of the United States have too, is people who are specifically watching for concussions, watching for someone to be acting strangely, moving unsteady on their legs, because that could be a sign of a concussion, especially after a collision. And so there have been instances where football players or American football players on the field have been signaling to stop games because they're noticing something and they need it fixed. The well-being of their opponent or their teammate needs to be looked into because something is not right. Y'all, ain't y'all checking? Is there no one checking? And so we've seen that a couple of times this season in American football. And so I know that this is a global thing, that at the end of the day, you are a competitor, but like nobody knows how dangerous it is to play a professional sport, especially a professional contact sport, like the players themselves. And so when you put that into effect, when you know when these players often see each other sometimes, especially during season, more than they see their own family, their spouses and children, you develop, especially teammates, you develop a relationship with them. And then you can appreciate how another team, even if it's the opposing team, the team that you're playing that night, has also spent the time and developed the bonds. Again, most of these players are in their 20s. We do have some who are late 20s and their 30s, but the majority of these teams are in their 20s. These are young people. They're not children, but they're young people who've got an immense amount of pressure on their shoulders. And so, like, the average age of a freaking coach globally, what is that, 40s? 37? It's probably in the 40s, if I'm honest with you, and older. Maybe it's skewing like 42. But like, that is perceived to be this person 20 years older than your youngest player, at least. And so these coaches, in many cases, the head coaches, I'm talking head coaches now, these head coaches are considered to be parental figures. And these young people are like their kids. And so anyway, I say all of that to say, there's an immense amount of pressure to play well for so many different reasons. And there's an immense amount of incentive for you not to listen to your body professionally. And there's a lot of medication out there that can, let's be honest, those shots that they get make you not feel pain while you're playing. But pain is our body's way of saying, go sit down in a corner. I need to recuperate. I need to rest. And so anyway, I think this whole thing is a great opportunity to do two things, to really take a step back and understand the real cost that's behind all of these players, especially in contact sports, who do these things for our meaning the viewer, the fans benefit. We need to be reminded. It's a good time to remind ourselves that there's an immense cost that these people are putting that comes with playing professionally. And you having ownership, you feeling like you own that player. No, you don't. No, you don't. Take a step back. You might really love a team, but you don't love the team more than this person enjoys playing for the team or feels like they need to because they're trying to play to get some money because maybe they're coming out of a poverty situation. Like, you are not more intense about the game than the individual player. So you might want to take a step back and just live in reality for a second, because if you make a mistake at work or you fail at something, like, you do, the likelihood of you being threatened by bodily, not threatened, but you losing your life at work is darn near nil unless you are in a high risk industry. You're an electrician. You work in transportation. You're a train conductor. But even train conductors, like, the likely, if you're in transportation, like highways and stuff, there are specific jobs that are very high risk, and we understand fishermen. There are specific jobs that are very high risk, and we understand that. But like, sometimes we disassociate so much because of the thing that these people produce. We only associate them with how good they're doing that thing, not all the risk that they take to do that thing. And this is a perfect opportunity for us to just recognize that these are human beings, many of whom, especially in sports, these professional sports, who have an immense amount of pressure on their shoulders and are probably playing injured more times than you think. And those injuries could impact their lives after, will definitely impact their lives after they finish sports. Again, I got a bum shoulder, or a shoulder that bothers me, and an ankle that bothers me if I don't wear the right equipment. And I haven't played sports in high school or high school level sports. I haven't played those sports in over 20 years. No, 20 years. Because again, you're a teenager. I think we don't put things in perspective. You are a teenager or a child when you start playing. I started track when I was 14. No, 13 years old. I was just a teenager when I started track, one of the sports that I love the most. And I'm pretty sure my shoulder injury came from track because I did shot put and discus. And I know I did not exercise correctly. We did not do the conditioning the right. We didn't condition the right way. I was doing a lot of weightlifting and powerlifting. And I'm pretty sure that that had an impact on why my shoulder, my right shoulder, bothers me some today. And yeah, so, and I haven't played, I haven't done any of that, any of, well, I did some of it in college, but like at least a decade, and I'm still plagued. Imagine if you're professional and you get out the league at like in your late 30s, 40s, you might still be plagued and your mind body, you might, all the knee replacements, but we take for granted how many replacements of things and how many torn this and torn that players have. LeBron James, wait, what? Somebody, people in basketball, they snap their Achilles all the time. They're snapping, not Achilles, but like hamstring all the time. Remember that one time where the player broke his femur coming down from getting a, he like landed wrong, trying to get a layup or something like that, or maybe after scoring a bucket, broke his femur on national, on live TV, and went back to playing the next, I think the next year he was back playing. You don't think that that thing, even after it's healed and the muscles healed and all of that stuff, you don't think that he will, in a couple of years, if not already, have some pain associated with that break? Because it's, again, it's not as if you and me broke something and then we're not putting a lot of, we have the time to heal and we go on about our regular day. These people, and we could choose to play our sport if we wanted to or not. Like, I was watching this YouTube or this TikToker who was like, I'm 47 years old and I've been playing basketball because I love basketball since I was a child, and I blew my knee out 10 years ago. And to this day, it bothers me, even though it got repaired, it bothers me to this day. But guess what I can do? I cannot play basketball if I don't want to. And there are times that, as though I love this game, sometimes I gotta rest to allow my knee to feel better and do the things that I need to do for my knee to feel better. Professional athletes don't have that luxury, especially with all those pressures that I mentioned before. And so this is just a good reminder for us to just take a step back and really kind of put our hopes and dreams in perspective, or not even hopes and dreams. Put things in perspective. Put them in perspective. That's all. I think that's just really what I wanted to say about that. Cause I'm just thinking of the most violent team sports, again, rugby, American football, soccer, Europe, American soccer and soccer. Like, you could take in American soccer and soccer, well, American soccer and football, you could take a cleat to the head. That's an easy concussion. You can hit somebody hard, easy concussion or worse. Literally, you can be hit. Somebody could be pushing you so you can get the ball. And that could be enough force to stop your heart. And when you're playing American soccer and football, you don't have pads. Well, you might have shin guards. You don't have equipment in football, or like American football, or even rugby. Chimney, freak Christmas. All the muscles in the world won't stop you from a concussion, baby. I heard a neuroscientist say, or a brain neuroscientist say, that sometimes, that think of your brain essentially has the consistency of room temperature butter. Soft, which is why it's sitting in fluid. But even there's not enough fluid in the whole wide world that can stop you. If you get a collision that essentially is if you're in a car crash, like every time you play the game, there's not enough fluid in the world to save your brain from that, which is why CTE is a thing. And if we're honest, CTE is probably a factor in every contact sport. Retired players, I bet you if we scanned all of their brains, if for the contact sports, I bet you all of them have signs of CTE, not just American football. Anyway, so like, like I said, I've said it like a million times already. This is a good opportunity to put things in perspective. No time like the present to really put things in perspective and recognize that these people are actually putting their whole bodies on the line for our enjoyment. And these leagues, oh, I have another piece about the leagues that I'll save for another time, but these leagues are not fooling me. Their business is the game. These players are their commodity. If you really wanted to look out for the well-being and welfare of these individuals, you would stop playing these games. That's just the cold hard truth. But that's not going to happen. So they're going to tell you they're going to do all of this stuff to make it safer. You know, the safest way to play American football is to never play it. That's the safest way. You know, the safest way to play soccer and American soccer and football globally is to not play it. But we're not going to do that. Rugby, the safest way to play it is to not. But we're not going to do that because there's a hunger and a desire for people to play the game because people want to watch you play the game. We're competitors by nature, so that's not going to happen. It's just this is a cost and we need to come to terms with it. I appreciate the efforts, though. I really do appreciate the efforts to make it safer, but let's not be naive. Ain't no padding in the world going to stop you from getting a concussion. It might. And ain't no, you can put all the rules in the world that you want in there. You're still playing these contact sports. You're going to get a concussion. Again, I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not anybody special. I'm just saying, like, these are contact sports and injury, serious injury is going to happen. And we need to come to terms with someone who's playing this game for our enjoyment, whose life will be changed forever. I don't even want to speculate on that player. Everybody else is doing that already, speculating on what's happened and all of that stuff. People speculate because it's a way for them to make sense of the world. I don't want to speculate on somebody's health status. It's too permanent, or at the very least, it's too life-changing. I'll wait for the reports to come out. But I'm not fooled by the league. Mental health support. If anything, I hope this opened up the dialogue for people to talk about the well-being, the physical and emotional and mental well-being of the players. I hope that this has opened that dialogue, because certainly that anybody thought that they could resume a game after seeing someone who appeared to be in their last moments on the field, you really think it's a good idea to go back and play? You really think when you see people openly weeping and somebody who looked like they were hyperventilating in one of those photos when we were watching it live, quarterback for the Bills looked like he was hyperventilating for a second there until he got himself together because he knew he was on camera. Other players on both teams openly weeping or looking like they had just seen the most horrific thing that they've ever seen in their life, because they had, scared out of their mind, or at the very least scared out of their mind because they didn't know what was happening, but they knew it wasn't good. And you mean to tell me we're about to resume in a little bit? No, you're not. No, you're not. Took you an hour to release a statement talking about the commissioner. Took you an hour to release a statement that the game was finished. What are you talking about? You hope that hour was you getting the language right. And maybe it was. But like, that game was finished the moment. And all of those commercial breaks, listen, I get, you know, you, somebody didn't pay you to get a spot. I know you got to get it in after all, this is a business. Down to the popcorn that they sell in the stands. All of this is a business, and it's a thriving ecosystem. I'm not knocking people for making money. I just want to put this thing in perspective. Anyhow, and have healthy conversations about this. Because of the immense pressure that we expect these people to play. We applaud people for playing when they have loved ones, close loved ones who passed away. That's not endearing to me. That's making someone play through trauma. I don't care if they're your star player. They're globally, and I'm about to go off on a tangent. Anyway, let us just be smarter about this. Let us use this opportunity as a way to talk about real healing. from trauma and the ways in which trauma can impact us, and then also the immense pressures that we put on professional athletes to perform through everything that they're going through. And the way that we talk about them and make them boil them down to just what they can do for our enjoyment. We really need to reexamine that and renew our minds on, we just need to do better. Anyway, all right, but so let me hasten on. I'm concluding that because I could literally talk about this for hours. But let me prep you real quick for the episode today, which is reviewing Knives Out. I have a lot to say about this. I think one thing is sometimes I get to talking and I skip parts or I miss parts or I mush scenes together. So just flow with me with that. I'm going to share spoilers. I'm not going to share all the spoilers. I'm not going to tell you how it totally ends. I'm not going to tell you the twist. But I've got a lot of feelings about this thing. I did enjoy it. I will cut to the chase. I did enjoy the film, although I got a lot to say about it. But I did just want to let you know that I have a tendency to smush scenes together. So if I smush a scene together, just charge it to my brain, go on and watch the thing. Anyway, to know really what's going on. But nevertheless, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sharing this with anybody that you think might dig it. And thank you for rating this thing 4 or 5 stars or better. But in the next segment, it's all about Netflix's Knives Out. Okay, so Knives Out, the sequel, well, excuse me, I shouldn't have said that. Glass Onion, the sequel to Knives Out. It's not even a sequel. It's just the second in a series, really, because one has nothing to do with the other, except that the only through line is Benoit Blanc, who is a famous detective, it seems, in this universe. And so it's like an Agatha Christie sort of affair with Poirot. It's like that series, but written and directed by, well, actually, I don't even know if this is based on a film, or excuse me, not a film, but like a book. I don't know if it's based on a series, but anyway, this comes out. It's the second opportunity for us to get to know Benoit Blanc. And so I'll go into more of that in a second. But first, I am just waking up from a nap, so just I'm shaking off the cobwebs. It has, at the moment, it's 7.3 out of 10 IMDb, 94% fresh, Rotten Tomatoes, 81%. From Metacritic, 84% from Google users, or at least 84% of Google users enjoyed this film, of which I am one. Rotten Tomatoes says between the critics' score is 94% with 355 reviewers, and 93% is the audience score with 500 reviews. And so the critics' consensus is Glass Onion, Knives Out mystery brings back Benoit Blanc for another wildly entertaining mystery rounded out by an outstanding ensemble cast. The audience says Glass Onion, Knives Out mystery solves the often deadly riddle of how to deliver a satisfying sequel to a movie that was nearly perfect to begin with. Again, I don't see this as a sequel. I see this as a continuation of that universe, but whatever. Because again, the only through line here is that there is a detective by the name of Benoit Blanc who is solving murders. This is a murder mystery. That is literally the only thing that ties one to the next. And just taking a step back, looking at these scores are very similar in terms of the reviews and the ratings are very similar to the first movie, Knives Out, that, you know, was certified fresh as well. This film was released, it was first released September 10th of this year, 2022, at the Toronto International Film Festival. And then it was released in US theaters November 23rd. And so with a box office, or at least with a budget of $40 million, it only made in its limited release. And when I say limited, it was like in the theaters for a week. It only made $15 million in that week. So, you know, it would have made its money back. I'm sure it did actually make its money back because it was released on Netflix December 23rd. I actually ended up watching it the day after Christmas, but, it was released, what was that, Friday? Yeah, Friday, December 23rd. I ended up watching it on the 26th, that Monday, the start of Kwanzaa. And anyway, so, this one, like the other one was, like the first one, was directed by Rian Johnson, written by Rian Johnson, or at least the screenplay was by Rian Johnson. It's in the film, the Knives Out film series, produced by Rian Johnson and Ram Bergman. It stars Daniel Craig, who's reprising his role as Benoit Blanc. It also, let me go back to the cast, let me just make sure, it also includes Janelle Monáe, who has a very important role in this thing. Kate Hudson, who plays a character that, in my opinion, is very cliche. I'll go into in a minute. I think I said Ed Norton, but I'll say it again. Ed Norton, who plays Miles Braun, who is the lead person, the lead rich guy in this film series. If you remember watching the first Knives Out, you know that that's centered around a rich white man, too. The stories in both of these are different. Again, which makes it different completely. It's just, I guess, becoming procedural at this point. Anyhow, Catherine Hahn plays Claire DiBella, who her face is very familiar to me. I couldn't tell you what she plays in, but I would imagine that for the most part, the broader target audience probably knows who she is. I just don't. I'll say something about the audience too in a minute. Dave Bautista was here, is playing a character here, and everybody knows, probably most people know Dave Bautista because he played a particular character in Guardians of the Galaxy. Leslie Odom Jr. is in here, and do you know he's not singing one note? It's very disappointing. But anyway, his pretty self is in here, and he's just dressing really well, playing Lionel Toussaint, who is a scientist. And I think I said Kate Hudson is in here as a socialite. Ethan Hawke is in here. He makes a cameo in here. Actually, let me save the cameos for a second. Did I tell everybody else who's in here? Madeline Klein plays Whiskey, which is Dave Bautista's character's girlfriend. Jessica Henwick plays Peg, who is Kate Hudson's character's assistant. I don't know who Madeline Klein is. I don't know who Jessica Henwick is. I only know Dave Bautista, Ed Norton, Daniel Craig, Kate Hudson, Janelle Monáe, of course, Leslie Odom Jr. Also who make appearances in here, Angela Lansbury, who is the queen of Murder, She Wrote, was the lady who played in Murder, She Wrote, a series that was on for like almost two decades. Anyway, she plays a cameo. She's in here. Angela Lansbury is here. Hugh Grant is in this thing. Ethan Hawke is in his thing as Miles' assistant. I've already said Ed Norton plays Miles Braun. Ethan Hawke is here as Miles, Miles' assistant. He's only in there for a little while. He does his scene and he's out. Hugh Grant is here, and I'll say more about him in a minute. Yo-Yo Ma makes a cameo as a partygoer, a guest of Kate Hudson's character, who is playing this, again, socialite, who's also something like a, I guess she's not necessarily a politician, but she's definitely one of these waspy, free thinker, COVID is something like a hoax, or at least herd immunity, and I don't have to take anything, it won't make me super sick, sort of people. And again, we need to remember that this thing was written and filmed at the start of the pandemic. Well, it was written at the start of the pandemic. Actually, I don't know when it was written, but it gives very much, this thing was thought out at the start of the pandemic, and so it includes a lot of themes, certainly that we're talking about, that we were talking about over the last 2 years. Anyhow, related to the pandemic, but let me go on. So Steve Sondheim, Serena Williams, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Natasha Lyonne, make cameos here. And let me just tell you the type of cameos they make. Okay, so Stephen Sondheim, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Natasha Lyonne, Angela Lansbury, we meet them because they are supposedly friends of Benoit Blanc, who is, by the way, in this world, one of the most famous detectives in the world. So of course he would have rich people friends, and these famous people are cheering him up because he's not. We meet Benoit Blanc in a bathtub, in his bathtub. And apparently he's depressed. He's depressed. It's still 2020. In this universe, it's 2020. He's depressed because he can't get out and travel like he wants to. And the world is kind of shut down. And he spends most of his time in the bathtub, taking a bubble bath, which you would seem to be one of the most calming, de-stressing, and on the face of it, one of the best things you can do for your own self-care. But like for him, it has become a coping mechanism that is unhealthy for him because he's not really getting out. And so Angela Lansbury, Stephen Sondheim, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Natasha Lyonne are all playing, and probably one other person whose name I've forgotten at this point, are all playing, what's the name of that? What was the name of that game that everybody was playing in the beginning of the pandemic? Oh, it was the one where you tried to figure out, and it was actually fitting, because this movie is full of little Easter eggs. In the very beginning, they're playing something like a murder mystery. Remember that? It's Us? No, it wasn't Us. It's that game where you have these little avatars who you can dress them up however, and you are in this spacecraft and you're going around trying to find imposters. I forgot what it was called, but that game that everybody was playing. And indeed, Benoit turned out to be terrible at that game. We learn in the very beginning that he's terrible with all murder mystery games. He's better at solving mysteries in like real life mysteries than manufactured ones. Anyway, so he's, you know, they're trying to cheer him up, whoop, whoop, whoop. And of course, the very beginning are where the first clues are let out. So you really should be paying attention throughout this whole thing. I will pause here to say that I'm gonna do my level best not to spoil the entire thing, but I'm definitely going to identify some Easter eggs that you need to be looking for, as well as the major themes of this thing. So Serena Williams is here at a certain point. She just makes a cameo because she's like she's being paid to give like workout advice or whatever. We've already explained Ethan Hawke's appearance. He's Mike's assistant, or Miles's assistant. Yo-Yo Ma, let me just say it again. Yo-Yo Ma is Kate Hudson's socialite's party guest. Because we meet Kate Hudson and she's having this debaucherous, risque in the fact that you got all these people. She's got an apartment full of people in lockdown with her who for all we know might be carriers of, like, she's created a crowd in a place, or what do you call it, a super spreader event in her apartment. She has at least 40 people in her apartment with her, and we meet her feeling bored. She even says it with her assistant Peg. And her assistant Peg has snatched her phone because she keeps typing out racist things, which is very interesting. And honestly, I feel like I'm more a part of this audience. I really do. I feel like for this Knives Out, I'm more the part of the target audience than for the original. The original target audience, it was a predominantly white cast with a few, with Lakeith Stanfield, and even the woman who played, I forget her name, but the Latinx character that was playing a Guatemalan woman. I mean, she's still lighter complexion. She's a person that has lighter complexion. So for all intents and purposes, it's a very pale film, the original. And I did not feel like I was a part of the crowd, even though Lakeith was in there. Like, it was one of those things that white people's films do. They have you have your token black person in it. So that first film, it's very much, okay, let's sprinkle a little color in here and let's make this rich white, this waspy rich white man befriend this Guatemalan Latinx woman who's also undocumented, and let's make them friends. Let's make him really latch on to her. And also what we know is that when he dies, because there's always got to be somebody that dies, and it's usually a rich person, and when the rich white man dies, he leaves his entire fortune to the Guatemalan undocumented worker. And the whole waspy family, who was very tolerant and very supportive of her, all of a sudden turns into their nastiest selves. And even one of the family is, or at least the son, is right-wing, ultra-conservative. And he's the butt of jokes, but nevertheless, when this Guatemalan undocumented worker becomes the owner of this mass fortune that all of these relatives of the dead white guy was trying to, or the dead rich guy was trying to get, now all of a sudden she's not on a family friend anymore, and they threatened to deport her. So anyway, that you got the sense that it was trying to speak to audiences that maybe weren't aware or needed to confront the idea that your tolerance and your all the Black Lives Matter shirts that you wear are only as good as you, as long as you feel that your life is not threatened in any way, or that your livelihood is not threatened in any way. But the minute that comes into question, oh, all of a sudden your loyalty is tested. And so that's kind of something that was talked about in that first movie. And again, not something that felt super new and fresh information for me, which made me feel like, in addition to the representation, that I was not necessarily the target audience. So flash forward to this movie. And I feel a little bit more like I'm a part of the target audience, because not only do you have the black man, which again, most of these films, black is represented by the man, and woman is represented, or excuse me, black is represented by a black male, and woman is typically represented by a white woman, or someone who's close, either a light-skinned person of color plus a white woman. And so that's literally the representation that you have, like literally. So in this film, I do appreciate that not only do we have Latinx representation, which I believe Peg is, and Jessica Henwick is a Latinx, is she? No, she's not. She's Asian. She's in the Asian diaspora. I'm so weird. Jessica Yulee Henwick. My bad. I'm being dumb. Anyway, well, I appreciate non-cliche Asian representation. So she's in it. You have Dave Bautista, who represents Latinx, but he's male. That's how we got it. Right? Because that's his background, right? Yeah, he's Latinx. Like his heritage. I know he was born in the United States, but his heritage, I swear his heritage is Latinx. No, Bill from DC. He ain't from no daggone DC. Anyway, what do I know? I'm sitting up here talking early life. Let's go to his early life, because this is important to me. Greek. No, and Filipino. That's a part of the diaspora. all right, that's a part of the diaspora. I promise you, I thought straight up Latinx, like nothing else, but he is kind of on the fair skin side. He just be in the sun. But okay, so we've got some Latinx representation in Bautista, right? Because the Philippines is in the diaspora, right? Am I tripping? Hold on, that's a part of the diaspora, right? Come on, is it considered Latinx? Come on, you're not doing what I need you to do. Diaspora. Shoot. Yes, wait. Second largest group after. All right, well, let me not, because I always considered the Filipino to be a part of the Latinx Hispanic diaspora, but maybe I'm tripping. Okay, so, but Bautista is a person, does he have, well, let me not identify him as a person of color if he don't. I don't know that he has, let me talk to my husband. Anyway, well, I'm going to pass this along, but I'm going to talk to my husband and see how he identifies, because I don't, it's not clear here. It's mostly just talking about his wrestling background. But anyway, I've always looked at him as a Latinx, a person of Latin descent, Latinx Hispanic descent. And I guess Filipino, learning that he's Greek, yes, but then also got Filipino background. One of his parents was Filipino. That makes me feel like he's a part of the diaspora. Here was my point. So you've got Yo-Yo Ma, who's a part of the Asian diaspora. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was part of the African diaspora. Who else is here? Yeah, it just feels like there's a little bit more color in this. And so I feel like people of color are meant to be, they're included in this thing a little bit more, because we all read murder mysteries. Let's be for real. I'm not the only one that watched almost every episode of Murder, She Wrote. I know I'm not. Anyway, so I feel more included in this. So, and the messaging still, though, it's still very much talking to people who, and I guess this is what I meant to say about the first one. This second one definitely feels like Ryan is trying to talk to people who might still be new to the concept of white privilege, but never saying white privilege, because apparently when you say stuff like that, it scares off people, mostly white people, or actually people of color who don't want to get into, who are scared by terms like that. So they never use white privilege. But what they do is the Ryan shows what white privilege looks like. And white privilege looks like Kate Hudson's character, who is a socialite, who's absolutely breaking the gathering codes wherever she is. Because remember, in the beginning of, in 2020 and into the, at least the first half of 2021, there were gathering codes. You could not have a certain amount of people in certain groups, or you could be fined. I can remember a bar allowed, there was a COVID capacity. You had limited capacity of amount of people who could be in your space, because you had to safely be able to assemble and socially distance. So mega religious spaces could open their doors, but that at a limited capacity. And restaurants and bars could open their doors, but at a limited capacity. And so, you know, I can remember in Maryland, there was a bar owner that was fined, what, $100,000 by the state of Maryland, because of course he was on the shore. That's where a lot of Confederate flags fly. And anyway, so he was on the shore, and opened a bar because he was like, F you, I don't believe in all of that stuff, even though we have a Republican governor. I'm not listening to this Republican governor and all your COVID-19 mumbo jumbo. So of course he was fined for real. There were a couple of churches, like Christian churches, that were fined. And I don't think, we were also learning that there are certain religious communities that were like, I wouldn't say it's all religious spaces, it was just some of the kookier Christians and some of the more orthodox and kooky Orthodox Jewish communities. But I wouldn't say it was all over the place. It was just pockets of those communities and probably other religious spaces too, who were like, bump that. We're going to do this anyway. I just only ever saw it where the ultra Orthodox community in New York was flipping out, being told what to do, when to gather, how to gather, and the vaccine, you know, being told to take the vaccine. And I can remember a bunch of Christian churches in the DMV and in Baltimore who were fined because they wanted to assemble, and they wasn't gonna let, them fools wasn't gonna let COVID or man stop them from doing the Lord's work. And then of course they put a lot of their people out at risk. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about them. They didn't got it enough losing half their doggone congregations being stupid. Anyway, and God bless those families who were impacted, because I don't know. So anyway, I'm about to go down a rabbit hole, but I don't know too many families, especially families of color, that have not been touched at least once, and sometimes multiple times. That's why that little stuff like that really upsets me, because it's always the people of color, poor people, and people whose faith are being twisted that end up being the recipients of all that bad stuff. Like they get it the worst. Anyhow, but I said all of that to say, so she's hosting this the clearly out of ordinance gathering, but of course there's no mention of a fine anywhere for her because she's a celebrity and whoop, whoop, whoop. I'm reminded of the party that Meg went to with Tory Lanez and her one-time friend at one of them Jenna girls' homes during 2020, when we all should have been stayed apart. And God knows how many people got COVID coming from that super spreader event. But anyway, I was gonna say something, but I'm not. Anyhow, so Kate Hudson is this cliche white woman socialite who has a bunch of brown people entertaining her and doesn't realize that she's using them for entertainment, because she'd be saying racist stuff and doesn't see how it correlates with the other one. And in this film, Ryan had made her say something anti-Semitic, which feels appropriate now, given that Kanye and his super clever self has decided that somehow or another it's cool to be anti-Semitic, right? Not even taking into account that Hitler did not. Girl, anyway, I'm not even going. We would have been in them chambers too had they got a hold to us. Like, let's be for real. Like, anyway, I can't even believe he be saying stuff. I swear to you, he'd just be saying stuff. He got to. Like, I don't want to give him too much credit, but like, that just sounds like some, I don't know. Anyway, I'm just taken aback by him saying that bull. Even the most racist, it's just hard for me that a black person would even adopt that. Recognize, how you gonna adopt the language of your oppressor? Like, in the language, literally the oppressive language of your oppressor. And even as I'm saying that, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, it's not that doggone hard. But I'm just, Kate Hudson's character is just angers me, because she is written very cliche. And nevertheless, she's written to embody that waspy, free thinker white woman who doesn't think that she's racist, but she's actually very problematic and be saying racist stuff all the time. She's supposed to embody that. And I know that Ryan is supposed to be talking to, again, she never says white privilege, or they never say anything about white privilege. In the film, nobody does. any of the characters that are right wing or seem very right wing, never say anything about Black Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter or anything like that. They don't say anything like that. But you get the sense that these represent the Trumpers. I think there's a mention of Trump, maybe, but it's not a lot. But again, you get the sense that this film is trying to target folks who don't feel like they're in that category, but they're totally in that category. And so anyway, her character just irks me because I know that's why she's there. Dave Bautista's character, and it's so wild to me because he's supposed to be playing the Trumper white man, basically, who has a YouTube, like a social media platform. And he's using his social media platform to be super misogynist. And you get the sense racist, but like, again, I never saw Bautista as a white man. I never saw him as a white man. Again, I acknowledge now that he has a parent that's Greek. So he's got European background in him, but again, I've never seen him as a white man, but it's so strange to me that his grandmother, the woman that plays his grandmother, who's this woman? Oh, Jackie Hoffman. It's like a little Jewish lady. And I'm like, I did not consider him to be white or even a part of the Jewish heritage. Like, no, I thought he was Latinx. Anyway, but you know how they do. They be doing people like that in films. If you are light skinned and you can kind of come across as a little bit racially ambiguous, they love to just say you anything, right? Yep. Anyway, so he's, for all intents and purposes, he's a white man who is supposed to be representing the Trumpers. And again, I kind of loathe his character because he's supposed to be representing Trumpers because he's got this blonde younger girlfriend on his arm who is always scantily clad. And that's played by Madeline Klein, who's Whiskey. Whiskey is his girlfriend. And so, yeah, he literally, there's a scene where he gets in the pool and comes out and he's got Speedos on, and tucked in his Speedos is a revolver. We actually meet him saying, spewing some anti-woman stuff in a recording or something like that. Like, I don't really know. It just seemed like a lot, but also it's supposed to, again, he's a caricature. So, and I guess I didn't realize in the first one that all of those folks were caricatures, but now looking at it, yeah, that's who these people are supposed to be. Caricatures of people that we know in real life, groups of people that we know in real life or that we see in real life. So whatever. And I get it. All films have characters that are supposed to represent a segment of the population. It feels like this is a little bit forced for me. I guess that's where I really wanted to say what I really wanted to say. Evelyn Jessica's character as the brown girl who's the assistant to this white woman that says racist stuff and who's a buffoon. She's very much an apologist, but also her career is wrapped up completely in this deplorable. I was trying not to say deplorable, but I could not say it. Because again, this is kind of what this film is kind of written like, that it's the speaking to largely the white liberal person who gets it. So I don't have to say it. You just get it. And the brown people who see themselves reflected in some capacity through the Leslie Odoms, through the Jessica Henwicks, through the Janelle Monáe characters, right? Even Bautista, who again, I know I'm not the only one that considered him Latinx, but anyway, I told you I might ask my husband. Anyhow, but let me keep going. So Ed Norton is the white billionaire guy who this whole movie revolves around. And even in the trailer, you see him as Miles Braun, you see him moving about, and the whole film, he's alive. He doesn't die. You think he's the one that dies. Actually, this is a murder mystery that is kind of like a caricature of its own self, because this whole film is based on Miles bringing all his friends back together on his private island that his rich billionaire money has paid for to play a murder mystery game. Literally, that is the reason why they are all on this island. They go to an island his island to play this murder mystery game. And apparently he brings all of his friends to his island, or to some trip. Maybe it's not always his island, but on some trip every year, to play with him, basically. And so we'll return to that concept in a minute. But anyhow, so let me move on to the next character. So again, I said Jessica Henwick plays Peg. Peg is Kate Hudson's assistant. And you get the sense that she's always getting Kate Hudson's character out of trouble. And so we meet Kate Hudson when Peg has taken her phone from her from saying one of the latest racist things that she's done. And but also she's in this pandemic party, penthouse party, because again, her boss is throwing it. And we've all been in situations, or you know somebody who's been in a situation where they work for somebody who they would not, but for their desire to make money and use this as an opportunity to do something else later, they would not be working for this person. And you get the sense that Peg do not want to work for Kate Hudson's character, but here we are. And here's the other thing that you also get. You do also get that Peg sees some redemption or redemptive qualities in Kate Hudson's character. It's just, you can tell she's holding her nose as she works for her. Anyhow, we don't get to know much about Peg's character, because all we know about her is her relationship with Kate Hudson's character, which feels kind of trashy when you consider we spend a lot of time, literally the bulk of the movie has 8 characters in it because it's a pandemic film. So there's a point where you're on an isolated island, you can't have but 8 characters present, and Peg is one of them. So we get to know all of these characters. Of course, we get to know the backstories of the main characters, but the side characters with Peg and Whiskey, we really don't hear much about. And I understand, you know, you don't have but so much time. So there's a piece of that I hear. I just wish we could learn a little bit more of both of these characters, but we never really do. Let me hasten on. Leslie Odom Jr. plays Lionel Toussaint, who is a scientist. We meet him in the lab, trying to convince a group of his peers who are working on a project with him, or maybe a part of a company with him, that he's trying to sell his peers on this latest idea that Miles has about a certain type of energy. And the energy is very volatile and it hasn't been tested. And you see Leslie talking about Miles as if he's a genius. He even says it a couple of times as he's reading out some of the ideas that Miles faxes Leslie. And the ideas are completely absurd, but Leslie is convinced that Miles predicted Bitcoin. And so most of his ideas sound terrible until they aren't terrible, until they're proven right. And you see that he was right about Bitcoin. He was right about this company. He's probably right about this technology, this volatile energy that we just have to figure out how to make stable. And so anyway, we meet him that way as a brilliant scientist who is at a point in his career where he's can take his science and take his career even further, but he's gambling hard on this discovery, and his colleagues are cautioning him, this ain't the horse you want to back. I know your friend is super eclectic and you think he's a genius. They're not saying this, but you get the sense that these people think that Miles is a quack and that he's just gotten lucky and that his luck's gonna run out on this particular thing, and they're trying to caution their colleague, baby, don't hit your wagon to this star. It's going to burn up. It's a supernova. It's going to explode. And so anyway, so that's how we meet Lionel as a brilliant person who is a champion for this person that he believes is a genius. And we haven't even met Miles at this point, but we've heard from, I think simultaneous, actually, let me go around because I was trying to go in order, but I'm not. So we meet Leslie talking about Miles, and we also meet Kate Hudson's character talking about Miles as genius. We meet Claire DeBella, Catherine Hahn's character, Claire DeBella, who was a politician working from home. She's about to do an interview with CNN, blah, 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 blah. She's a busy mom with a career and all of that stuff. She's the governor, actually. She's the governor of a northern state. I've forgotten it. I think it was Massachusetts. She's the governor of Massachusetts. And we meet her, and I guess the only way I can describe her is that, I don't know, she feels like her... The actress that's playing her feels like she's overacting. She's a typical politician in that, she seems kind of stuffy and boring, but like about her work, and is invested in keeping up her image, I guess, of this tough person who's got strong opinions about particular things, and the thing that she happens to be pretty strong or have strong opinions about is clean energy. And so I think we meet, I don't know, I can't remember the order, but as the movie goes along, we get the sense that both Claire and Lionel are close with each other, but they're close for not the reasons that you think. They're close because they both believe in Miles, but they're also nervous about this technology that he's talking about. And remember, Lionel is a scientist who's working on making this energy, this new energy, stable. And Claire is an energy champion. She's a self-proclaimed governor who's an energy champion, who, you know, probably could, whose people could probably benefit, or her constituents could probably benefit from this technology that's supposed to be clean energy. And so anyway, you automatically get the sense that those two are, or at least as the movie goes on, you get the sense that both of them are in not cahoots with each other, but they have a vested interest in, they're both kind of wrapped up in the success of this technology being able to work. For different reasons, right? Miles would create the technology, and Claire would pass the legislation, at least help pass the legislation as governor across the country to make it be used and across the country. So anyway, and again, we really don't know what Kate Hudson's part in all of this is, except for she's one of his waspy friends who says problematic things and is supposed to be a free spirit. But I think we also learn that she's something like a socialite, but also like she has some sort of a talent. She's like something like a model. Maybe she's a singer. We get the sense that that's in her past. And right now she's resting on the socialite piece. Okay. I talked about Dave Bautista. I think Dave Bautista's character, and I apologize, I'm still dealing with my stuffiness. So we talked about Dave Bautista's character, and I think the only thing that I want to say about Madeline Klein's character, Whiskey, is that she is a social media star who is along for the ride with Dave Bautista's character. That's how we meet her, and she confirms that, her character confirms that. Whiskey confirms it in the middle of the film. And so Whiskey and Dave Bautista's character, Kate Hudson's character and Peg, Lionel Toussaint and Claire DeBella have all been summoned through a puzzle box, an elaborate puzzle box, have all been summoned by Miles Braun to visit him on the island to play the murder mystery game. Also summoned to the island is Janelle Monáe's character, who we get the sense that she had a falling out with Miles Braun. And very early in the film, we get the sense that they started this company together that now only Miles runs, and he's super rich. We get the sense that she made some money too, but that their relationship dissolved over a business decision, and they went to court Now, we learn at the end, after someone has died, we learn toward the end of the film, as Benoit Blanc is on the island too. He's been invited on the island, not by Miles, but by someone who wanted him there, at first it's like, oh, maybe Miles thinks that he was invited because, oh, this is just going to be really cool. We're going to play a murder mystery. Why not bring the preeminent detective to help us solve it, or to try to throw us off of our game while we're trying to solve this thing. Either way, Miles ends up formally inviting Benoit Blanc there, and a good thing, because somebody is murdered and Benoit Blanc is trying to find the culprit. At the end of the film, what we end up learning is that Miles is not a great person. And the reason why Miles and Janelle Monáe's characters, their relationship dissolved, was because Miles, and a wild choice that he was going to end up making, Janelle Monáe's character didn't agree with. And so she ends up walking from the company that she created with Miles, and tries to sue for the rights. But Miles ends up, I will tell you this, Miles ends up, because certainly their split is like the bulk of the film. Their split and everyone's reaction to it are the bulk of the film. When they split, when Miles and Janelle Monáe's character split, all of the friend group went with Miles. And we don't know why that is. We know that Janelle Monáe's character thinks that they're all opportunists. And it turns out, in the end of the film, we do learn that they were all opportunists. We kind of get that sense in the beginning, as everybody's talking about how much of a genius Miles is. We get the sense that, well, do y'all really think he's a genius, or are you just along for the ride because he's got a lot of money? And Claire, he helped your financial campaign, or he helped your political campaign significantly. Kate Hudson's character, he put you on the map so that you can have this cushy life where you're just a socialite. Lionel, he got you out the classroom and put you in the lab full time so that you could live your best life that way. And Dave Bautista's character, he helped your social media. He helped your social media take off so that you can live the life that you're living now. And so are you all indebted to him? Did you all go with him, side with him instead of Janelle Monáe's character, because he's just your rich daddy? And so Janelle Monáe's character calls all of them out on that, and they actually don't deny it. And Dave Bautista's character goes so far as to say, yeah, we're like that, and you were like that at one point, and then you turned against him, and you wanted us to come with you, but you lost, baby. We not ashamed. You the one that should have been ashamed. Anyway, so at the end of the film, the mystery is solved. The mystery is solved, and I will tell you this. We discover at the end of the film, there's one obvious murder, and then there was a murder that only two people at on the island knew. And then at the end, everyone learns who the second murdered person was and who actually did it. And the end is satisfying, but not in the way that you think. Again, it's a little bit cliche because it's not a typical cookie cutter end, but it's an ending that is still good, still relevant all the same. I'll say that. And so, yeah, overall, I did enjoy this film, even though I felt like I was a part of the target audience, but I wasn't like the main audience, because a lot of the themes that were talked about are not new concepts to me, but they might be new to a person. They might be new to a person who is not comfortable talking about some of these things. And so for that, you know, you use your art to push a message. I appreciate that. And you're not too pushy about it, but you're just stating a fact. Benoit Blanc, Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc is still a good character. I still really like him. I'm going to watch the next one when it comes out because it's good. And he plays a good Benoit Blanc detective. We'll say this. Hugh Grant is in this film. And I didn't say this before, but Hugh Grant is in this film. And Ryan sets Hugh Grant up as Benoit Blanc's partner. But it's not one of those things that a conservative person would say, oh, there you go, shoving down this gay stuff down my throat. It's not even like that. It's just a thing that is. And it's refreshing. It's cool. I don't know. I appreciate that it was. How about that? And so anyway, I enjoyed the film. Cliches and all. Yeah, I still really enjoyed the film. I do look forward to the next one. I have watched it now 4 times. I am going to watch it again because I do like it. I think I do like it better than the original. And so, yeah, so that's that on that. Well, I'm finished. Thanks so much for listening. I do appreciate you. I know we're getting back to things. So happy new year. Probably you should be back at work now doing what you do at work these days. So hopefully you're listening to this while you're doing a task you don't want to do and it's helping you to pass the time. So I appreciate you for helping me pass the time with you or whatever. Anyway, take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. It's a brand new dawn. It's a brand new day. Brand new opportunity. And yeah, until next time, take care.